This is a really important conversation for people to understand. This is, you know, sort of general population forgets that your money deposited in a financial institution is working for someone else. It is being invested somewhere. And if your money is in a global bank, I can guarantee you it is in coal, it's in oil, it's in pharmaceutical, it's in privatized prisons. So what I encourage people to do is get values aligned with their money.
Welcome to the Problematic Podcast, a show that gives you the chance to be the hero in helping solve some of the world's largest problems. Find out which teams need your skills today at problematic.app. And now, here's your host, Sean Tierney.
Welcome to the Problematic Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Tierney, and today I am with Kimber Lanning. Kimber is CEO of Local First Arizona, an organization in its 19th year that is dedicated to building a diverse and inclusive economy. They have 3,500 business members, three offices in Arizona, and a team of 38 staff. Across 2020 and 2021, they distributed a total of $30 million in small business relief aid and $5 million in technical assistance. Kimber is recipient of the Arizona Valley Leadership Woman of the Year Award for 2021. She's also owner of Stinkweeds in Arizona, in Phoenix, Arizona, a record store in its 35th year of business. Kimber is also owner of the famous Modified Arts Creative Space, which was, among other things, a music venue where I actually saw Jimmy Eat World play many years ago. And in a former life, Kimber was also a drummer in a shoegaze rock band called Half String. Kimber, you are the first guest of this podcast. I'm so excited. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be the first guest. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So I have read through annual reports and websites and videos and stuff, and I figured you do so much stuff with the organization that you're involved with. Can you just, at a high level, talk about Local First and what is the problem that you're solving?
You know, we're solving for multiple issues, but in a nutshell, we have this wide wealth gap that continues to erupt, not only in the United States, but really across the country. And we believe inherently that entrepreneurship is our strongest weapon to battle the wealth gap, and in particular, the racial wealth gap. And so we are, everything that we do is tied back to building a more inclusive opportunity for people to participate in the economy. And so what I mean by that is, you know, a lot of folks don't realize how many people have been pushed to a shadow economy, who have been limited in their access to capital, who don't even have access to healthy food, which again puts you on your heels, right? You're then battling your health throughout most of your life. So our goal is to empower not only individuals, but their families and their communities by opening up doors of opportunity around entrepreneurship, which again, enables people to build that mobility to help them empower their families.
Absolutely. And so we could probably talk for an hour about just those things that you listed. Sure. And I know from your website, you do a lot more. Mm-hmm. What would you say are the ramifications of this wealth gap? If left unchecked, in other words, what without Local First, what happens from there? Where do we end up?
Civil war and the end of nations. I mean, it's just as simple as that. When people can't feed their families despite working 18 hours a day, they just simply won't tolerate it. This is history. You know, it's not my perfect crystal ball. Yeah. This is history. And if people think it can't happen here in the United States, they're wrong.
Yeah. It's funny. I'm reading a book right now by Ray Dalio called The Changing World Order. And he talks about this, you know, this arc that all great empires follow of this rise and, you know, stagnancy and decline. Right. And I think you're right. I think it's a design pattern not unique to us. It's just
right. And I think the challenge is waking up people who happen to be either born into or built, they are part of the haves, waking up those folks to understand that we're not talking about charity. We are not talking about you need to disrupt your perfect lifestyle in order to enable somebody else to do better. We're simply saying if we invest in communities to provide them the opportunity to actually build generational wealth, they will do it. So before you can do that, you need to acknowledge that there have been systemic barriers that have prevented them from doing that. So one thing I like to do to get people awakened to my perspective is to talk about the GI Bill, right? At the end of World War II, all those soldiers coming back to the United States, we introduced the mortgage, right? Extending a massive amount of credit so that we could get families into homes via extension of credit for a mortgage, right? Mm-hmm. Many people don't realize that African Americans were not allowed the same access. So in all of the soldiers returning from World War II, only 9 African American soldiers were offered a mortgage. The rest were sent to rent in primarily projects in the Midwest. And so inherently from there, families were able to build generational wealth off the equity of those homes. They were able to send their kids to college, and it just multiplies. If you were sent to rent, you know, at the end of World War II, you didn't have any additional equity built up. You didn't have the ability to send your kids to college. And so I think today, for people to understand what we mean when we talk about building an inclusive economy, we first need to recognize those barriers that were deeply racist in nature and unfair, and acknowledge those so that we can begin to build down those barriers and open up access to capital and the building of generational wealth.
Yeah, and it's like, it's funny, prior to doing all this research and digging into what you actually do, my impression of what Local First was that you guys were opposed to big box stores coming in, and, you know, like Amazons and Walmarts, and just the evisceration of small business mm-hmm. from the local economy. But it sounds like the vision is actually bigger than that. You're now talking about, like, well, yes, that's part of it, but then how do we also empower these people that have, you know, been marginalized and get them to the same level where they can participate in
right.
the wealth?
Right. So I think at the core is that when we talk about local business ownership, we're really talking about economic opportunity. And so when we started, we were really just grappling with the tip of the iceberg, which is really comes from my orientation as a middle-aged white lady, which is the problem is local versus corporate. But it, to your point, we have evolved where we've recognized the problem is actually much grander than that. So that's still at the core. You know, people need to understand that our government gives massive subsidies to chain stores to move into our community and extract wealth and bring us low-wage jobs. So the example that I like to give is the Cabela's model. Most people think Cabela's is in the business of outdoor sporting goods and fishing tackle. They're actually in the business of subsidies. So they average $35 million per store in subsidy. So a subsidy is when you take government money and give it to a corporation. So let's play this out with a racial lens. You've got a company moving into Glendale, Arizona. They got $68 million in subsidies. They set up shop there. They claimed they were going to be the second largest tourist attraction in the state of Arizona after the Grand Canyon, which is laughable, right? So they implemented what is called a sales tax abatement. So that was part of the package they received. A sales tax abatement is when they were able to take, you know, you went in, you bought your tent, you paid your sales tax. They got to keep that sales tax for 10 years and not pay it into the city coffer. So think about the racialized twist when you're taking money that is earmarked for parks, libraries, swimming pools, fire departments, and you're now taking that money out of those systems that benefit all communities, but in particular communities of color, right. And you're now saying that gets to go to the profit toward the bottom line, which is 99% white shareholders that don't even live in Arizona. So
quick question, why are these subsidies necessary? It seems like we've got a massive market where, you know, Phoenix is the fourth biggest city or whatever it is. Why is it even necessary to entice those companies with subsidies? I would assume they want to be here.
Exactly. So this was the battle that we took on early at Local First Arizona. And I think your point is the question that we were asking. And so the unintended consequence of paying economic developers by the number of quote unquote jobs they attract mm-hmm. is it causes them to go after companies that they can claim they relocated here because that's how they earn a living.
Okay.
So nobody was ever asking the question, do we actually have to pay them? Instead, the focus was on how can I get them here because that's how I earn a living. So we advocate that economic developers should not be paid by the number of jobs they attract unless they're also dinged for the number of jobs they jobs they eliminate.
It's got to be the net. Yeah,
it has to be the net. And it never was. We were successful here in Arizona of putting a stop to those subsidies for a number of different arguments that we made, but primarily the argument that they don't need to be here and we should not be taking government money and what I would call picking winners and losers, right? We can't just be investing government dollars into independent businesses.
Right. And so you're not actually advocating banning big box stores. You're just advocating level the playing field so there aren't subsidies.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. Let's just level the playing field and also educate the population. So in other words, we'll take Walmart as an example. Walmart, at their height, they were the largest employer in the state of Arizona. 83% of their employees have no health care benefits. So those employees end up on the state's health care program. So the public needs to understand we're paying for the health care of their employees, right? And once people start to realize that, the prices don't look quite as cheap as they appear on the shelf, right? We call that deferred billing. We're substituting what we think is a cheap price, and we're paying an enormous amount of tax to cover that. In you know, it's healthcare benefits are one of the number one costs for a business.
Yeah, and that makes total sense. Like, I can understand how in that game of telephone where there's employees who are, you know, have quotas and whatnot to attract a certain amount of business, and everyone is just doing what they think is best even. This isn't even necessarily malicious, but it's the sum total of that chain of events that it sounds like leads us to where we are.
That's right, and that's how Local First started, was simply bringing a practical and rational mindset and asking those hard questions. You know, we came in and did an economic study of the state of Arizona's $5 million office supply contract all the way back in 2007, and we were able to prove they were losing $500,000 a year because they were awarding contracts to companies that brought the state part-time employees with no healthcare benefits, something that had never occurred to them before.
Have you gotten any, like, you guys were able to distribute $30 million in relief during COVID, which was arguably just a hellacious time for everyone. How did that go, and why did they turn to you for that? And because I know, like, California, it seems to, like, they had kind of some horror stories of how it was abused and whatnot. It sounds like you guys were already in operation. You were doing well. And did the state turn to you, or the federal government turn to you because they thought you knew what you were doing? Or how did that come together?
It was a little bit of both. So right at the beginning of COVID, in like April of 2020, we started reaching out to any partners that we have to try to put a fund together to try to save some of these small businesses. When the PPP came out, it became evident that they had overlooked a huge number of people that are self-employed that didn't have like an LLC. They were simply operating as a sole proprietor. They were disqualified. So that means barbers, beauticians, anybody that was out there as a sole proprietor was disqualified. So our original goal was simply to help them because they are everywhere. It can be a yoga instructor, it can be anything. And so in that, the state of Arizona recognized, first of all, that we were already doing that. But also, many people don't realize we are the Rural Development Council for the state of Arizona, which is a federal designation. And so we're already working in all 15 counties. And so they contacted us and they said, would you be able to distribute $5 million? Which we had never done anything that big at that time. And our goal was to raise a few hundred thousand dollars. Yeah. And they said, can you do $5 million? And we said, yes, because, you know, my mother taught me never let them see you sweat. So I said, absolutely. And then they called the next day and said, the governor decided he wants to do $10 million. And so you just don't blink.
Yeah.
And I hung up the phone and I was a little wheezy and I thought, wow, okay, we've got to, you know, we've got to figure this out. Well, I'm proud to say we put out the media release and we had applications from all 15 counties within 24 hours. And right there, the state just put up their hands and said, we could have never done that. And so it's about relationships and knowing who in each one of those remote counties to be able to get the word out to get the word to the small remote businesses that are out there. When you start thinking about small towns, tribal businesses, and others, it's not easy to reach them with a media release, right? You have to have the relationships to get the word out there. So to answer your question, partly we were already doing it, and partly the state knew there was no one better suited than us.
That's awesome. So you were that distribution network that just kind of the channels to reach everyone that you needed to reach.
That's it. That's it. And then in addition, they came back with additional money. We're going to be doing an additional $2.5 million coming up here shortly as part of the Back to Work grants, which will provide up to $10,000 for businesses to be able to incentivize workers, right? So we can compete with some of the big guys that are offering signing bonuses and things like that. And then for Maricopa County, we've distributed over $10 million just in Maricopa County as well. The county tapped us after they saw our track record with the state. So it just keeps growing, and we're doing $7 million for the city of Phoenix as well.
That's awesome. You have talked about no culture, no soul. I think I saw that in one of the interviews you did. I had a startup in Tempe at the time when Google, maybe 10 years or 12 years ago, famously came here, and then they left. They said there's just like, and the reason they cited was that we just didn't have culture or soul in Phoenix. So that stood out to me. What is your opinion? I've also heard you say that like good design is very important, you know, to like make a place walkable and engaging and whatnot.
Right.
Can you talk about that?
Like, yes, that is. So I'm find myself consistently asking planners in the greater Phoenix area if they've ever been to a big city, right? Because what we've effectively done here is we've made tear down culture very easy to tear down older buildings. And then we've taken a suburban mindset and applied it to vertical development. Mm-hmm. And so right now we have this wave of, you know, what we would call 4-over-1, which is that ground floor and then four levels of apartments going up everywhere. And they're, you know, I like the devil's in the details, right? They're bland, they're not walkable. And usually the ground floor is, you know, an empty gym in, it's not a way to activate a street. And so I love your example of Google. So for those of you that don't know the Phoenix area, we have massive roadways that are like 6 lanes wide, and they drop down in an office building at the midpoint between 2-mile-apart intersections. You know, we're like a grid here. And there was nothing around. And I ran over as soon as I heard they were going to be moving in there, you know, like you would approach a car crash, like, no, you know. And I asked the city of Tempe, what were they doing to connect their employees to this place? And they looked at me like I was speaking a foreign language.
Yeah.
And they said, well, we took them over to, you know, there was like some Irish pub around the corner on University. That was their welcome. And right. I just hang my head that there's so many things we could have done to not only engage those employees, but their spouses, partners, families, when they relocated to Arizona, to help them put their roots down. Mm-hmm. But it has to be intentional or they're not going to stick. You know, we have a TGen, which is a research center that is in downtown Phoenix that had massive amounts of turnover. And again, you've got guys moving here from places like Chicago, where they're used to not even having a car. And you've got a real estate team that's plopping them down in Scottsdale and North Phoenix. So here's this person who hasn't even had a car in the last 10 years. Suddenly, right. They're commuting 45 minutes each way. They don't know any of their neighbors where they moved in, and they're battling traffic. And there's nowhere to even engage, much less have your spouse engage. So it needs to be very intentional. And part of what we try to do at Local First Arizona with our, whether you look at localfirstaz.com or our other websites like Good Food Finder, we are trying to connect people to place, you know, to ensure that, you know, they are more likely to stay here and put up roots.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's spot on. Like they did not think holistically at that level of like, how are people actually engaging with this place, and do they envision themselves staying here? And
right,
yeah, if they're used to these places like Chicago, then yeah, that's a huge.
I mean, the office they picked, you would have to pay me to walk down a half a mile from their office in any direction.
Yeah.
I mean, 6 months out of the year, it is hot. You got six lanes of traffic flying by. There's nothing to look at. Why they picked that office is beyond me. But further, knowing they picked that office, they should have gone into overdrive. And how are we going to connect these folks?
Right.
Yeah.
So what are some of these... I mean, you listed some compensatory things like getting in there and figuring out how to connect them and thinking beyond just the employee, but to the rest of the family unit, because that's important too. What are things that you guys do to solve this problem, like to engender this?
So we have a few different things. We have tools like Small Wonders Maps, which highlights cool, independent, local restaurants, boutiques, destination-type places in a certain neighborhood. So those are available both printed and digitally so people can, you know, find out what's in their near area that's worth checking out. Events, we're really big on events. So whether you're talking about the Devour Culinary Festival, we won the Best Southwest Culinary Festival from the New York Times, bringing together all of Valley's best chefs into one place. Our fall festival attracts 30,000 people, and you can go out and learn 100 to 120 locally owned businesses. And then from a policy side, encouraging our cities and towns to focus and prioritize the adaptive reuse of existing buildings, eliminating the teardown culture, making it easier to open up a business in an old building, and then design for urban walkability. You know, the ground floor has to be activated with retail, restaurant, not just a leasing suite and an empty gym. That is not urban development. We have apartment complexes in Phoenix that you cannot exit onto the street. You have to exit to the parking garage. And that's when I said, you know, suburban mindset only in a vertical orientation. Yep. That's what I mean. If you have to leave your apartment and go to the garage and get in your car and take a right and a right and a right to get to the coffee shop in the base of your own building, you're not going to do it.
Yeah.
And plus, there's no parking. So, you know, and then these guys sort of shrug and say, well, we told you Phoenix wasn't ready for a ground floor. And it's ridiculous that I'm having these conversations with architects.
So is this a policy change that needs to happen, or is this just education of like good design or what?
So it's a combination, and I'm glad you asked that question, because this is one of the things that I would chalk up as a failure. We thought the win was to mandate ground floor retail. Mm-hmm. We thought that was the win, and we advocated it, and I can't even tell you how many meetings and how many teeth had to be pulled in order to mandate ground floor retail. Mm-hmm. And then they found a loophole that a gym qualifies. Right. So that's why you drive down Roosevelt Row, which is an arts district that is, without any argument, the most vibrant and dense area in all of Phoenix. And there's six apartment complexes that have just empty elliptical machines that sit there all day on the ground floor.
Yeah.
So therein comes your second recommendation, which is education. And, you know, an organization like ours, there's so many hours in the day where you can sit down with design teams and try to convince them they need to activate the ground floor in a different way, especially when their model continues to work and make money for them.
Right. So ultimately, it seems like until you fix the financial incentives piece of this, it's really kind of an uphill
Correct.
Battle.
That's exactly right.
You talked in one of your interviews about this kind of push-pull between relationships and convenience. There's kind of a dichotomy, like two camps of people that want the Amazon convenience and then the people that want the relationships of like boutique mom-and-pop stores and stuff. How do you... And I'm guilty. Like, I'll be the first one to admit that, like, I use Amazon. It's just so freaking fast and cheap and convenient that it's like, how are you going to change the behavior of a population that is becoming growingly used to this level of, you know, it's going to be drone delivery at some point? Like, how do you break that and convince people of the value of engaging local businesses?
Yeah. So I think it's important, and that's probably the biggest question that you will ask. I think it's important first to recognize that part of what has happened is that Amazon has convinced us that they're the only ones that can do that, right? I was just on the phone earlier with a friend who ordered a mouse. Their mouse broke on their home computer, and they ordered it from Wist, which is a third generation company based out of Tempe, and it was delivered first thing the next morning, right? So part of it is remembering there are alternative places to buy. I mean, I buy all my books from Changing Hands and I get them right away, or I can pick them up because it's so convenient, either one. Yeah. So that's the first piece is, you know, the constant barrage, recognizing you're a victim of the constant barrage of advertising, and then that you've been sucked into the ease of use, right? The second thing is getting to people to a place where they really understand the danger of monopoly. And this country was founded, and there are really heavy antitrust laws to support the competition. And when you don't have that competition, it's very scary. So Local First is really active right now in pressuring our government to implement, not just to use our existing antitrust laws, because they haven't been enforced in the last 20 years. But, you know, it's staggering that 68% of small businesses will say that Amazon fees keep inching up and it's causing their businesses to fail. Mm-hmm. And there are countless examples of where Amazon uses the data. If something is selling really well, they will actually rip it off, model it, and sell it cheaper. And yet people look at these ads on TV that, oh, Amazon helps small businesses, when really they victimize small businesses over and over again. So I think that's a piece of it. And I also think that, you know, you use the word cheap, it's so cheap. It's truly costing us a fortune, you know, and I know it's an unpopular thing to say, but just as I said, you know, what happens if we don't check the wealth gap, civil war, what happens if we don't check companies like Amazon, from monopolistic behavior and control of big data, our economy fails.
So how do you... So it's cheap in that moment to that person in that context. Right, how do you close the loop, though, and make the long-term cost apparent to that person so they do alter their behavior? And I'm myself included here, right?
It's going to have to start with people of privilege, people who have the means to make the choice. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, does it matter if I'm buying a mouse if it's $5 more? It makes no difference to me whatsoever. Yep. So it's going to have to start there. Not all people have that choice. And then there's even the people on the low end of the spectrum who aren't buying anything from Amazon because they're not buying anything. Mm-hmm. Except for groceries, whatever they can get their hands on nearby, mm-hmm. And sometimes fast food. So it's going to have to start there, and it's going to have to be a crunch in the middle. So those people that are prioritizing a diverse and inclusive economy and can afford to do so are going to have to say, no, we're not doing it that way. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to have to convince the federal government to enact and enforce antitrust laws to break those companies up, which is, in my opinion, what needs to happen.
And to do that, because obviously they have a great deal of wealth and power to fight that off, that I would assume requires a groundswell of the population agreeing with that and demanding that.
That's right. That's right. And really, I think our best path to do that is not the conversation around shopping or ease of shopping. It's around abuse of power and data. Mm-hmm. And what they are now doing to us with
algorithms and manipulation.
That's right. Yeah, people don't realize how manipulated they are in terms of what they're seeing on their screens all day, every day.
I don't know if you've seen the movie The Social Dilemma. It's about particularly social media, not Amazon in this scenario. But I watched that about a year and a half ago, and then just promptly left all social media. Like it was powerful enough to make me realize that the algorithms are, whether we like it or not, modeling our behavior.
Sure.
And causing it, like, to me, it could be the cigarettes of our generation. Like we could find out 20 years from now that this was like the worst thing in the world for our brains. Like we're rewiring our brains unbeknownst to us.
That's right. Yeah. And there's things we just don't know. You know, the other day I had my phone on me, but I wasn't on the phone. And I asked my husband if he'd ever heard of this new place opened up called Dickie's Barbecue. And I said, what the hell is Dickie's Barbecue? It looks like a big chain, and I've never heard of it before.
And we're going to get ads for it now.
That's exactly right. My whole computer blew up with ads for Dickie's Barbecue. Yeah. And even yesterday, I got a gift card for a clothing store. Didn't say it out loud, but I put it next to my laptop and an ad popped up for that company. Never seen one before. And it was just sitting, you know, it's like it's got a code some on the back and RFID, some kind of a chip in it or something. I don't know. But we just truly don't know. And people should be very, very scared.
Yeah, that's and that's not even an opt-in. That's not like an Alexa or a Google. That's a phone where you did not ask for that to have that capability. It's
that's
just
right.
Picking up on it. That's terrifying.
That's right.
All right. Well, you divide up your efforts. I know you've got a couple different sections and you categorize mm-hmm. them in a certain ways. Can you just like kind of quickly just give an overview of how this all fits together and what the pieces are?
Right. So a key area where we're working is rebuilding Arizona's food system. Mm-hmm. So the way I would describe our food system is that we have a lot of eaters and we have a lot of growers. And in between there is processing, packaging, and distribution. And those three areas are woefully broken. Mm-hmm. So most of the food that's grown in Arizona gets shipped off to feed someone else. And then you don't have systems like farm to school. We read a lot about farm to school. Farm to school is not going to happen in Arizona because we don't have processing and packaging and distribution systems to make that work. So cafeteria worker mm-hmm. wants a prepackaged bag of shredded lettuce mm-hmm. that's ready to go. Mm-hmm. Farmer has a head of dirty lettuce. Mm-hmm. And there's no way to make that marriage right now. So we either have farmers markets, which are fabulous social outlets, but they rarely afford somebody a living to be able to sell at a farmers market, or you're shipping it, you know, out of state. And so our goal at Local First is to relocalize our food system, help people understand where their food comes from, and really empower individuals by the neighborhood to tap into their local food system, grow their own food, know who's growing their food, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So we run the Good Food Finder website. We run the Farmland Preservation Coalition. Mm-hmm. We also have someone coming on board that is focused on indigenous foodways. So we have, you know, we also do a lot around incubating food entrepreneurs. We run commercial kitchens that, you know, we're building up food entrepreneurs in that space. So there's a lot of engagement there around access to food. And then we are the Rural Development Council for the state of Arizona. So we are bridging the rural-urban divide. And I've written quite a lot about the inequities in policies and laws. For example, here in Arizona, we have a new law that they're debating right now with the legislature where, you know, here we are sitting in the middle of the fifth largest city in America, and they talk about how it's going to benefit schools. But if you read the fine print, 120 rural school districts are going to lose even more money. So this is just another example of the way the urban areas are dominating the rural areas and how can we create more equity there. And then we are also addressing the climate crisis. You know, one of the things we really noticed is our big utilities and our large municipalities and even our state, if they're putting together these climate action plans, they're largely focused on anchor institutions, global entities that have a presence here, and residents. Nobody's addressing the tens of thousands of small businesses in between there. And I think, Sean, this is really important. Banks aren't lending for small businesses to do the types of retrofits to reduce their climate impacts mm-hmm. to meet any of the goals or, you know, projections that are being established. And if you don't have the capital, let's just say you're a restaurant, and we'll walk through this together. If you're a restaurant and you say, okay, I want to replace my entire HVAC system, all my water fixtures, and we're going to start minimizing waste, we're going to install composting, et cetera, I need, let's just say, $68,000 in order to do that. A bank is going to immediately say, show us your last 3 years of tax returns. coming out of COVID. I mean, they wouldn't have looked good before, but now there's no chance they're going to qualify for that money. So what we're doing at Local First, we're going into those businesses, establishing a baseline, and then doing their projections going forward of their reduced usage and how that equates to savings, and using that savings to evaluate their ability to repay. So instead of looking in the rearview mirror, we're now looking in the future at their projected savings, giving them the money at like 2 or 3% interest based on their savings as a repayment method.
Right.
So it's really kind of turning the financial sector upside down. So we have a green loan fund that we've rolled out that is actually turned out to be very, very effective.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Well, and I know you've also been involved, speaking of banks, that whole Move Your Money campaign, which I think is brilliant. Yeah. I did so I used to be with Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and Chase, all the big three way back in the day. And I will never forget when we started our company, Jumpbox, they gave us a line of credit, $30,000 line of credit, said it's yours, use it when you need it. We didn't need it for the first 2 years. When we finally needed it, we went to use it and they revoked it.
Right.
And it wasn't a proactive, like, hey guys, by the way, you no longer have access to this. It was when we really needed to use it, they decided, no, you're no longer, like, times have changed, different economic landscape, and this money is no longer available to you. And that, to me, I moved to a credit union as soon as that happened. Like, this is, they don't care.
Right. And so I think this is a really important conversation for people to understand. This is, you know, sort of general population forgets that your money deposited in a financial institution is working for someone else. It is being invested somewhere. And if your money is in a global bank, I can guarantee you it is in coal, it's in oil, it's in pharmaceutical, it's in privatized prisons. So what I encourage people to do is get values aligned with their money. If you're going to have deposits somewhere, keep it as close to home as you can. You know, the closer money is to your home, the more compassionate that money will be. And you can have a voice. Our small credit unions and community banks, they're chartered here in Arizona, which means they are lending here in Arizona. And we can have an opportunity to know where that money may be invested. And so we advocate and have been successful in getting people to move their money out of those three big banks. And we're at about 11% so far, 11% of market share we've been able to move, which is a big number over the last 8 years. It's a big number.
So they don't like you very much.
They
don't. Are you concerned at all for the...
not really. You know, you would think if they had a leg to stand on, they would be more vocal in their opposition. But mostly they call and try to convince me they're not that bad. Mm-hmm. Or another trick that they have is... the amount of donations and volunteers they deploy, which really shields the damage they have done, particularly in communities of color. Any of your listeners could just type in Wells Fargo and redlining, or Chase and, you know, racist lending policies. If you don't believe me, these are stories that happened in the last 5 to 10 years. These banks have paid huge fines for essentially breaking the law and unfair lending practices. Chase, just there was a big study in the New York Times. They just did a little independent study. If you had a Latino surname, you were 35% less likely to get a call back on a loan inquiry just for your name.
Unbelievable. So equalized across all other variables purely based on the name.
That's it. Yeah. So it's pretty shocking. So I would encourage people to really think about where their money is and whether or not its values aligned. And again, we need to deglobalize the financial system as much as we can.
How do you, in something where it's got to be difficult to track where money goes at the level of like spend it here and then it gets moved here and then it's now kind of circulating in the economy, do you have any way when you patronize a local business versus go to an Amazon of representing that? Because I mean, to me, that seems like that would be the thing that if you can clearly demonstrate that, that's kind of how you win the hearts and minds of people once they see like, oh, this is going back into my community and it's translating to X,
yeah.
you know,
Yeah, so we've done enormous studies. We also partnered with a group out of Scottsdale, Arizona called Applied Economics, and another group out of Austin, Texas called Civic Economics. And anybody can visit their websites. But these studies have been done to really measure where dollars go when you spend them. And they've demonstrated the same thing over and over again, which is roughly 3.5 times more money stays in the local economy when you spend it locally versus not. So that equates to, for every dollar that you spend, it depending on the study, 3/4 of that stays in the local economy versus about 1/3 of it when you spend it at a national chain. And the types of things they measure, and most folks don't think about this, the local business that you're supporting is going to hire a local, maybe a graphic designer or a website developer or a payroll service provider or some other local company. And the national, especially here in a state like Arizona where we don't have the headquarters, those companies, like a Starbucks, for example, they have one graphic design firm and it's in Washington State. They have one website developer and it's in Washington State.
Right.
So if you've got a child in college right now that wants to be a website developer or a graphic designer, you should be spending your money with local companies because it inherently creates more opportunity for those companies to survive.
That's a really good point. All the trickle-down effects of spending at that local store. That's a really good point.
I'll tell you a funny story. I was speaking to a group of graphic designers one time, and a woman in the front row, it was like a conference, right? A woman in the front row, when I was describing how money moves through the economy, she smacked herself in the forehead so loud that I actually heard it. And I said, are you okay? She said, yeah, I'm just mad at myself. And I said, why is that? And she said, because I own a graphic design firm. I used to have 7 employees. Today I have 4, and it looks like tomorrow I'm going to have 3. And it never occurred to me until right now that I should be spending my money with companies that might actually hire me. She was like, I've been spending all my money with companies that are never going to hire a small graphic design firm, the big chains, right?
Yeah.
So she was disconnected from her economy and suddenly realized that her own habits were causing that disconnection.
It's not something that you, unless you're consciously, deliberately trying to piece that together, it's not something that occurs to you every day.
Right.
And, we're in this stuff every day. We have our habits and our spending habits and whatnot. And unless someone hits you in the face like that with it really doesn't.
Well, I like to remind folks, in this country, we're in a consumer-driven economy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're in the driver's seat. So we have choices to make. Do I think Amazon's going away tomorrow? Absolutely, it's not. But if we demand more from them, and at the same time we're mindful of spending less with them, they will change some of their habits. A company like Walmart, when we started, Walmart wasn't sourcing anything locally. And now they go out of their way to source more locally. And it's not because of us. I'm not arrogant enough to think it's because of us. But in a time like this, when gas is $5 a gallon, having a business model based on food or on, food too, but any sort of, globalized economy where you're importing goods at a massive scale, suddenly your business model doesn't work anymore. So the future is local, folks. That's what I have to say. The future is local. We've tried this global experiment and it's been very harmful and it's caused a huge wealth gap that will lead to the end of all nations if we can't figure it out.
Cool. Well, let's transition into, we've talked a lot about the different problems at this point. What do you see? I mean, you have all these programs, so those are your solutions. Can you just, and you've enumerated a couple of them, kind of set that aside for a second and imagine, is there anything else, like the average person, if there was a volunteer group and they wanted to work on something together, what could you imagine them building? Is it an awareness campaign? Is it an app? Like, what needs to exist to help chip away at some of these issues?
I think that everyday folks need to connect in their communities. So to your point, bringing people together, hosting meetings with locally owned businesses, that's how I started. I went door to door and started to put together these monthly meetings. And I would get, more than 80 to 100 business owners showing up to have a conversation with each other. Discovering that some of their challenges were the same. And you have, one guy that owns, I'm just going to make this up, but a shoe shop complaining about all of his customers that are buying online And then you ask him about his own habits and he's sure. buying online. Yeah. Right. So when you meet your neighbor, suddenly you can't do that so easily. And you start to think about, wait a minute, my actions are impacting all these other folks. You know, I was just sitting in my own corner with my own lens on this, feeling grumpy. And yeah. now look at how everybody else is doing the same thing. So I think bringing people together is a critical piece of it. Using your voice. Here's another example. The city of Phoenix announced they were going to spend several million dollars feeding COVID-impacted families. Mm-hmm. Sounds innocent enough. Well, I picked up the phone and I called and I said, would you consider letting us manage that? And they said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, you could hire Aramark to make all those meals, and they would deliver those meals with no locally sourced ingredients, and they would deliver them in styrofoam,
yeah,
which never goes away.
Yeah.
Or you can let us manage it, and we put out an RFP, a request for proposals from farms, a request for proposal for restaurants, and we married the two. So we hired 14 farms, 45 restaurants, and then we went out to a local restaurant supply company, and we sourced, I don't even remember, hundreds of thousands of compostable to-go containers. And required all of them to use it. So every restaurant agreed to use at least three locally sourced ingredients in every single meal. And so we just created a pipeline, farm to restaurant, and here we are 21 months later producing 5,000 meals a week, and we can prove we're supporting 280 jobs, and we kept 57 businesses operating right through the height of COVID. Wow. And that, we didn't even... It wasn't because we were so smart. Anybody can raise their hand and say, hey, isn't there a better way to do this? How could we be leveraging government money to amplify local jobs? And anyone can be asking those questions.
Yeah. Well, it's very much aligned with the vision for this project. And this is brand new. Like I said, you're my mm-hmm. first guest. So I could be hallucinating here. But my thinking is, by involving people in the solution, when they hear it, it's one thing to hear it and say, oh yeah, that sucks, that's a problem. But when you realize you don't just have to shake your fist at the air, but you can, there's actually something you can contribute to and get involved. Absolutely. And do something about it. I've got two ideas that I wanted to list. Like in going through all this, I just jotted these down, but it seems to me that awareness is a component. And then once you are aware and now you want to do something about it, it's how can my energy be spent? And so to me, those two pieces, I think back to like that ALS ice bucket challenge. As silly as that was, that thing raised over $100 million.
Right.
So is there some kind of viral awareness campaign you could envision where the average person, like you said, you talk to your neighbor and then you can't go back. Now you're thinking about your own spending habits. You're like, oh yeah, I'm not spending in my backyard, so I got to change that. So it's almost like some type of awareness campaign around that, where you can get people to start thinking locally and understand the ramifications of spending in, mm-hmm. you know, Washington or wherever it is. Mm-hmm.
That is our Buy Local campaign. And yeah. the Buy Local campaigns really peaked around, I don't know, 2010 or 12. And we still see signage, you know, about why it's important to support local. And if you just type in Buy Local, we'll probably come up first at Local First Arizona. Mm-hmm. But I think that, like most things, once people see it over and over again, they sort of become numb to it. So I would welcome any of your listener ideas about how we could make it seem fresh and new.
Yeah.
But I mean, that is, for almost 20 years, what we've been telling people is how important that is. And I think an important piece of that I want to underscore is nobody's going to change 100% of their behavior. Now, I'm not going to walk away from you and you're never going to buy from Amazon again. That's not going to happen. And I'm not here to make you feel guilty. You know, we're never going to make a movement out of making people feel badly. So what we did is we did a study looking at the 10% shift. And we discovered that if everyone in the town, in a town the size of Tucson, which is roughly at that time 600,000 people, if everyone there could just shift 10% of their spending from a national to a local company, it would create $130 million new recirculating in that community and 1,600 brand new jobs. So when people, you know, I'll ask that at the end of my talks all the time, who here can be with me and shift 10%? Everybody can shift 10%, right?
Yep.
And there's always the really difficult negative person that's like, they don't make socks locally. Well, I know. That's not what I'm talking about. You know, there's many things we can do. A local oil change, a local haircut, choosing a local movie theater. There's so many things that we can do. And we would just encourage people to take baby steps.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you've already got me thinking about it. I think it's just every time that something pops into mind that you need to buy, your immediate inclination is, oh, that's easy. It's already got my information. It's prime right. delivery right. one day, like now same day with the distribution center here. I think it's really just, if you can insert something like a little pre-process that intercepts that and says, can I get this locally? If yes, then go do it. If not, mm-hmm. okay, Amazon.
Right.
And right. 10% should be a no-brainer. Like, yeah, I would think you could, you know, 30% change in people's behavior if they truly grasp the ramifications and
agreed.
They understand.
Agreed. And what we ask with the 10% shift is, if you look at your spending and you're spending 30% locally, we want you to get to 40%. And big picture, you know, I have my mortgage with a local credit union. I bank local. Those are big changes. And so we just try to root them as much as we possibly can. At Local First, we have local payroll service provider. We even have a local phone company called Nextivo, which is based out of Scottsdale. I mean, we've looked high and low. Mm-hmm. And then when we can't source it locally, we do all refurbished MacBooks for our staff mm-hmm. Because we don't want to just go and buy new ones. There's so many great refurbished ones out there. Why not buy them, you know? And that we're supporting local jobs in doing that.
Yeah, I think too, like once people understand, we're not even appealing to altruism. This is like, do it because it's actually beneficial to you, and you're preserving, right. you're avoiding civil war, and you're preserving your right. local community.
And you know, another thing that I really want to underscore is sometimes it's not even something as far off as, you know, this will help your grandkids, which is why we're struggling with the climate crisis, which is a whole other conversation, right? People can't see how it benefits them today. But, you know, taking these steps, if you're a small business owner, the number one thing you should do is know other companies locally that might want to hire you for your services, right? If you're not in your community, you're missing out on business that could be coming your way. Yep. So there is the immediate gratification for that as well. And I always remind, you know, I talked to a very large nonprofit healthcare company like that provides direct clinical services. Their mission on their website is to ensure that everyone has access to high quality healthcare. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. You walk over to their purchasing department, and 90% of their money was being spent with companies that don't offer healthcare for their own employees.
Yeah.
And when I pointed that out, their heads exploded because it had never occurred to them
yeah.
that their money was actually undermining their own mission.
Yeah. This sounds like a common theme. Like it's,
yeah.
And it's not malicious. It's, right. I really think it's not malicious. I think it's just a absence of thought.
It's just a disconnect from how we each are our orientation to the economy.
Let me give you the other idea. So that was awareness, and you guys already have your outreach campaign, it sounds like, but some way of visualizing where the money is going when you spend it. Mm-hmm. I've always thought, like, for instance, with when we pay our taxes, if we got a receipt that showed how that money was being allocated, we'd probably be outraged and we'd probably like press, you know, for a different behavior. If there's some way to help people visualize when they spend the $5 at Starbucks versus the $5 at, you know, Press Cafe or whatever the local coffee shop is, what, like, there's got to be an app or some way of visualization, I would think, of mm-hmm. making it very, like, just tangible and immediate to see, oh yeah, that's what's happening with right. that money.
Well, I love opening it up to any of your listeners who have ideas. We have tons of graphics that we've been sharing for years. In fact, one time we even created these giant 7-foot shopping bags and we filled them up 3/4 of the way. Like, this is how much money stays local when you spend your money locally. And
yep.
people love doing selfies with them. And, you know, we've done pie charts, graphics of all kinds. I don't know about an app. You know, I don't know that people would look it up regularly, but maybe. I think so.
Yeah, I just think, like, there's some segment of the, I mean, I'm overly on this boat, but, like, I'm big into the quantified self stuff, so I use, like, the sleep tracker and the Aura Ring, you know, the Apple Health, and, you know, I look at stuff periodic screen time. You know, you look at these things, like, weekly to see, like, how did I do? What's my report card? You know, what's the progress? And I feel like people, that if you get them concerned enough about this and you make it easy and frictionless enough, it might be something where they would check an app, you know, once a week to see like, where did my money go this week? Oh yeah, I saved, like I've contributed now to an extra $100 in the local Arizona economy. Like that might actually be motivating enough. If you can truly trace it back to your spending and see where it went and feel good about it, I think that might change.
I love that. And so one of the things, my question is, would people implement a new process to get that information? So my thought was, years ago, I approached QuickBooks and I said, you know, again, we work primarily with small businesses.
Yep.
In QuickBooks, would you be willing to add a checkbox for every expenditure, whether or not it's local?
Yeah.
And that way, it would be easy for a business at the end of the month to try to hit certain goals in terms of a percentage local. You know, you could say, wow, I spent 23%. You know, we have a program at Local First called Source AZ where we go in and analyze purchasing and we'll report back, you know, hey, you're spending 42% locally. Here's some ideas for what we would call import substitution to get you up to 58% if you'll make these changes.
Yeah.
But QuickBooks, which is owned by Intuit, they said, no, it's too much trouble.
Sure.
but my thought, you can see, is I want to add the process to existing software so right. we're not asking people to go to a separate place to make this work.
Well, yeah, I mean, that sounds amazing. It's a B2B type approach to it.
Right.
It would require like tiny bit of extra, you know, an added checkbox mm-hmm. in their process. Mm-hmm. What about going to someone like a mint.com or one of these like services that, you know, I use it for personal finance. It tracks all your spending and then it could just be an automated report from them. It wouldn't require any extra work from the user at that point. It would literally be like, just go check your mint.com to see what portion you spent locally versus foreign.
Right. And so then you get into the definition of local, because that would be really difficult. So a lot of people will say, well, Ace Hardware is local. And I would say, no, it's a franchise.
Right.
Right. It's in between local and a chain. True Value is more localized than Ace because it's actually an employee owned model.
Right.
But that's, you know, that's where
but
you
that's
are.
An app. That's something that could be built though. Like if we had some open source developers that were listening and they said, okay, we could make a mapping that would go, you know, take the export of your mint.com and it would flag it according to, you know, which places were local versus right. which were remote.
Right.
And you have some kind of mapping table that does that. I mean, that type of thing is not without reason, you know, that could be built.
I'd love it. I would love it. And I wish we had this conversation 10 years ago because we stubbed our toe on this particular concept many, many times.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Kimber, I think we probably just at about an hour. How can people get involved, learn more about you? Where do you want to send them from here?
I would encourage you to go to localfirstaz.com. You can sign up for our newsletter. You can follow us on social media. We're pretty hyper local, but it gives you a lot of ideas for how we're managing this. I do a lot of speaking around the country and a couple times around the world. If I can help you create a buy local coalition, I'd be more than happy to chat with you about where you're at in the process and how we might be helpful.
And actually, this raises a good point. So right now, you're focused on Arizona. Are there plans to take this framework that you've developed and go elsewhere, or is it?
No, I would rather assist other people who are hyper-local to their place rather than us trying to do it.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So, but you are willing, though, to chat with other folks, other yous and other places who are trying to make this happen in their locales.
Absolutely. Yeah. I helped a group form in Lufana, Germany, and then you know dozens across the United States. Not necessarily help them form, but help them raise the money, help them with ideas, those types of things. So, I absolutely am available for those conversations.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been a treat. I will let you know if we get any volunteers, and I will list the two projects that I mentioned. If any others come up. This is all, by the way, a work in progress, as you know how small businesses work. This is a brand new project. So if this functionality does not yet exist on the website by the time of this airing, it will soon. And look there for if there are any projects to join on this problem. Kimber, thank you so much for joining.
Oh, thank you so much. Take care.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the Problematic Podcast. To get involved and propose a project idea of your own, or to join in the discussion around one of the projects proposed during the show, visit problematic.app. That's problem, ATTIC.app. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a rating and review on your favorite platform. Until next time, be the change.